Or maybe the pitching was so good it didn't make it much
difference.
Well,
that's probably
he was strictly an offensive catcher, strictly.
Okay, I think we're all set to start here.
Okay.
Why don't we start off with what we were just talking about? What type of field you all think it would be to play on? AstroTurf.
Are you going to open this thing up with an intro or not?
What we're going
to
do?
Just going to put it on tape. That's it. We'll piece it together.
Yeah, then we're going to piece it together. And what we'll do is then Jack will lay down the intro to all this stuff.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So.
Let's start it this way. I think one thing that. Mm-hmm. Should be discussed, and Tim O'Neill brought it up. What kind of surface should this game be played on? Regular turf?
I don't think it would make a great deal of difference.
It wouldn't, so far as the 42 team is concerned, because it was a team built for speed. It was one of the two reasons that the Cardinals disposed of Johnny Mize after the 41 season. A number of the players on the team were teed off with John after the 41 season because they thought he was malingering with injuries. But basically, Billy Southworth said, I want a team that can run, and we're going to have speed. So I think it would work just as well on AstroTurf. You agree?
I think you're right. I think that if the game is played on grass, which it will be because this game is played at Sportsman's Park, I understand, it will benefit the 67 club a bit because, as Bob Burns said, the 42 club had this tremendous speed. Stengel, Casey could enact with his own inimitable style the Cardinals pressuring his infielders, shaking their hands and their legs trembling in the outfield as they tried to corral that club. And with the artificial turf, they would be going not only first to third, but they'd be hitting the ball in the gaps more and fewer strikeout hitters also. I think in that era, where there were fewer strikeouts, the more contact you make, especially guys that hit the ball with any kind of overspin like Muzio, you may hit them a little bit more in a double play now and then, but you'd also get a lot more base hits.
And yet the 67 club wasn't exactly a slowpoke club either.
No, they depended a lot, even though Lou Brock stole a prodigious number of bases. It was a hit and run and go.
Sure, they had fellows on that team who could run players like Javier and Brock and Kurt Flood. McCarver, for a catcher, was outstanding.
Yeah,
in fact,
right.
I think he led the league in triples, and I can't recall the last time a catcher led the league in triples.
But you know, Walker Cooper in those days ran like
that's
a reindeer
right.
also. He was not the big, heavy guy that people saw in later years, right, Arliss?
Right,
until he had knee problems, that's correct.
Right.
So I don't really believe the type of surface on which you're playing would make a great deal of difference.
Yeah. You know, I think we ought to backtrack just a second to say, for the benefit of an audience that is probably ranges four in difference in years, there's been arguments over the years about the ball clubs. When I was a kid, they thought the 31 Cardinals were the best club ever because they'd won so handily with a veteran team that wound up with a lot of men who became managers. And also, we know the Gas House Gang was colorful, but this team, these two teams meeting now, would be the team that won the most games ever, the 42 club, and the club that certainly is probably the best of what they call a modern generation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Meaning a 67.
Yes.
I know a year ago I did a series of stories for the Redbird Review, and I came to the conclusion, going over, that these were the two best teams in Cardinal history, the 67 Cardinals and the 42 Cardinals. But the 42 Cardinals, perhaps by projection, in that this team was great after the 1st of August, had a sensational finish, won the World Series in 5 games, but would have been much better if it were not then torn apart by World War II.
Well, that's right. I think we're thinking here is that Tim O'Neill and Forsyth are using a computer, as I understand, based on that one season alone. We're not taking the Gibson, who had the 1.12 earned run average of 1968 and probably the best one single season pitcher maybe any of us ever saw. But on the other hand, they're taking the Mark Cooper, who had the 1.78 earned run average of 1942. So there's a bit of an equalizer there. But to me, overall, listen, if they played a series, I think the depth of the 42 club's pitching would be a difference. But this is just one game.
Yeah, but then again, Cooper, although pitching the first game, was never seen again in the 42 series.
Yes, he was. He pitched the fourth game.
He came back and pitched the fourth game.
He was given a 6-1 lead. He was knocked out in the sixth inning when the Yankees
scored
5 runs. Made it 6-6, but then the Cardinals came right back and took the lead and won the game 9-6.
Whereas Gibson, I think, rated by both Marty Marion and Musial, believe that Gibson was obviously, you know, shoulders in a way the better pitcher of the two.
Well, it was obviously.
I was just thinking last night about this in preparation for this. The Cardinals had so many pitchers in 42 that as they were coming up to the cutdown deadline of 25 players, they played a series in Pittsburgh, and Billy Southworth used four rookies in four successive games. One of them, named Hank Garnicky, pitched a one-hitter, and the next day wound up in Columbus. And John Grodzicki, who may have been, had he not been hurt in World War II, the best of all these pitchers, had a bad outing, and he was sent out. Ernie White and Johnny Beasley made the bulk of it as a result of the shutouts that they pitched in that series. That's how many pitchers they had to play with in this thing in 42.
Was Paulette a rookie in that team, too?
Who?
He came up in August the year before. So, in effect, he might have even still qualified under the rookie rule now.
But he did not have a good year in 42.
Well, not especially. But you know, he's right. This is a fruition. The 42 club is the fruition of Branch Rickey's 22-year farm system idea. At that time, the Cardinals had the best ball club in Houston, the Texas League, Rochester in the International League, Columbus in the American Association, Sacramento in the Pacific Coast League. And as Bud Blattner put it, he's probably right. He said, other than the Dodgers and the Cardinals, you probably could have taken all the farm club stars, because just on the threshold waiting were Wilkes, Burkine, and Munger, and Brazel, just to name four pitchers. Mm-hmm. But they probably could have finished third. So this was, with rookies, it's amazing. This team, if you want to call them rookies, technically, certainly, Kurowski, Musial, Sanders, Harry Walker, Beasley, and as he said, Paulette had just come up the year before. That's incredible that a team that young with only one regular, Terry Moore, who was 30 years old, could spread eagle the field. It's incredible. As Bob Burns said, what their future would have been without World War II. Or put it this way, if Anheuser-Busch had bought the ball club then and spent the money that the brewery did in his early years in a futile effort to build, the Cardinals, as Musial said, probably won 10 pennants in a row.
Right.
And yet the 67 club was no hump to either when you consider that Gibson was out for almost 2 months and Bryles stepped into the breach and won nine. In fact, the Cardinals gained ground with Gibson out.
Yeah, that's incredible. Right.
Yeah, the point is that we've been talking about the 42 team, to which I'm partial because I loved them. But the 67 team was not chopped liver. It was a good baseball team.
Absolutely.
No, that's
because
right.
When you can gain ground without Gibson, that's amazing.
Well, they had a remarkable infield. That infield, I think partly through illness by Mazeroski, entire infield was in the All-Star game, right?
Right.
Cepeda, Javier, I was thinking of the 64 infield.
But you, excuse me, Jack, go ahead.
No, but I think Bob made a point. But even so, even though he may not have been the All-Star infield, I mean, Cepeda, who was the MVP that year.
That's right.
And Javier, who hit .281. You know, he had just become a pretty good hitter in his own right.
Well, they're both excellent fielders, too.
Yeah. And although Maxwell was probably the weak sister, but still, and Mike Shannon drove in 77 runs playing third base that year, too.
Yeah, just looking at the 67 starting lineup of Brock, Flood, Maris, Cepeda, McCarver, Shannon, Javier, Maxwell, and Gibson, there's not a weakness there. Now, you might make a case that Maxie was not much of a hitter. In comparison to the 42 team, Jimmy Brown was a fire plug and a spark plug and had a great World Series, but he was not that great a second baseman. And the other one, Frank Crespi, was injured all year. Terry Moore was great in center. Slaughter was great in right. Musial was great in left. Cooper, an outstanding catcher. Johnny Hopp, marginal at first base. They had brought up Ray Sanders to replace Mize, and Sanders did not develop. So they put in Johnny Hopp, and he played well. But Kurowski at third, Marion Chart, and Mark Cooper. So you have perhaps one and a half weaknesses on the 42 team, or maybe you have a half a weakness on the 67 team.
I guess in summary, you got one of the greatest shortstops ever. Marion, as you say, one of the greatest center fielders ever, as a middleman in one of the great outfielders ever, at great outfields, Musial's Moore and Slaughter, and the speed, and I think the greatest depth of pitching I've ever seen. If you look at that year's record, Mark Cooper was 22-7 with a 1.78 ERA, Beasley 21-6 with a 2.13 ERA, and Howie Crist, a reliever who sometimes started 13-3, Max Lanier's 13-8, Harry Gumbert, an excellent reliever, 9-5. Paulette, as Bob Burns said, just regressing a bit momentarily, 7-5. And Ernie White, who had arm trouble good bit of the year, was 7-5, but then wound up pitching a World Series shutout, the first pitch against the Yankees since Jess Haynes in 1926. And Murray Dixon, 6-3. Now, that's incredible depth, right. I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Ernie White, I was, again, thinking about him last night as I was rehearsing for this, I guess. And actually, he was from a small town called Pacolet Mills, mm-hmm. South Carolina. Mm-hmm. Blondish-haired guy. And I kept trying to think, who, some present person, reminded me of the way the piquant look on his face around the eye. He is a carbon copy of Jody Powell, President Carter's running man.
And his disposition is a lot like Dave LaPointe.
A Cinderella story, I guess, 2-for-67, was the emergence of Dick Hughes, who came from nowhere spent about 9 years in the minor leagues, and suddenly to lead the National League with a 16-6 record, and for the Cardinals. And of course, I remember one game in particular, Cincinnati, where he almost pitched a perfect game until a rain delay.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I think the Cardinals won.
It's a game he lost on a triple play.
So it was a strange season in that, having lost Gibson in mid-July, and I remember arriving in Cincinnati and the Cincinnati papers quoting Gene Mock, whose Phillies had just left the previous series, saying the Cardinals is dead. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they came on to win going away.
You talked about Dick Hughes' near-perfect game. It gets back to the World Series again. The Cardinals lost the first game of the World Series to the Yankees, to Red Ruffing. Ruffing had a no-hitter into the eighth inning of the first game, and then Terry Moore singled. But then they knocked out Ruffing in the ninth inning and scored four runs and had the tying runs on base when the last out was made. But after that, they took off. They won the second game behind Beasley. And then the third game, as Bob Bregg mentioned, Ernie White pitched a brilliant 2-0 shutout, aided by three outstanding catches by each of the outfielders, Moore, Slaughter, and Musial, and a bizarre ruling on a bunt changed it around. Then in the fourth game, as we mentioned, Mort Cooper was given a 6-1 lead, was knocked out in the sixth inning. The Cardinals came right back, regained the lead, and we're now ahead 9-6, and then the final game where Beasley again won on a home run by Kurowski.
Yeah, I think it's incredible that team, which probably still has the best sustained finish I've ever heard, 43-9. That team beating the Yankees 4 out of 5. The Yankees had lost only 4 times in 9 World Series from 1927, 4 out of 36 games, and lost 4 and 5 to that team. That was remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
But as you were saying, Jack, and Bob Bragg both, the pitching depth on that 1942 team was incredible. Southworth said, I remember talking to him one time, Beasley was the one that fooled him. He didn't think he was as good as several. He didn't think he was as good as Garnicky. He didn't think he was as good as Grodzicki and a couple of others. And yet, Beasley was the one that came on and was tough down the stretch, as was Mark Cooper. And yet, with all the pitching depth they had, they needed an extra pitcher late in the season, and brought up the ancient Bill Beckman of St. Louis and from Rochester. Bill was in his 30s. He did a long career with the Athletic. And he pitched a game in Philadelphia. They had to win and won it.
Nobody said a word about a fellow who's still around now, and that's Steve Carlton.
Yeah.
He was 14-9 at 67 club.
Yeah.
And
He missed a bunt player. He probably won a World Series game too, right?
But, of course, he was at the stage then where I guess things, the Murphy's Law, always to whom the Murphy's Law always applied, considering that 2 years later he struck out 19 and still lost.
Yeah.
But still, I think Steve was starting to come into his own, and of course, the Cardinals had an outstanding reliever in Joe Harner, who saved about 15 games, and their pitching depth wasn't exactly, as Bob mentioned earlier, just chopped liver.
And was that the year that Larry Jaster had his incredible record?
No, that was the year before.
The year before, yeah.
Because the Dodgers were defending world champions.
Right.
You know, it was an anecdote about Gibson's injury and how they overcame that. We know that a few years later, unfortunately, just the reverse happened when Gibson hurt his leg with sliding back into first base at New York. The Cardinals lost the 74 pennant because the club didn't 73 pennant. That's right, because he didn't react at all in his absence. But that you and I had been in the All-Star game, Bob, when in 67 at Anaheim. On the way back, I stopped at Las Vegas, standing in line for a dinner show on a Saturday night, and the scores were coming in, and because of the time difference and an early Saturday start, the Cardinals game was over, and the guy was putting the line score on the blackboard, and he underlined the word Gibson, hurt, and just double-lined with his chalk, and the guy walked over to the odds in the National League race and changed the odds. And a little while later...
You can see that one coming.
Yeah, a little while later, I bump into Joe DiMaggio. He's catching an elevator, and he said, I just heard about Gibson. He said, looks like your club's in real trouble. Yeah, yeah. I said, yes, doesn't it? And as Jack said, Bryles came through handsomely. It was a fantastic, such a fantastic year. What did Stan Musial in his only year as general manager, hey, he's playing against himself in this series, in this game.
Pretty hard to do, but he can do it.
Stan made only one roster move, didn't he?
I think there were a couple. You got LeMabe, and I think there was one other deal that I recall.
But that was incredible. Yeah. You talk about putting a team on the field the way the fans say in cliche and leaving it. That team stayed on the field all year, whereas in 42, the Cardinals really opened with Sanders at first base, Crespi at second base, and Brown at third base, and then after... Kurowski came in, Brown moved to second, and Hop took it first. So despite their great record, they had some changes,
right?
They had
to make some changes, but the 1967 lineup was pretty much intact. And yet, looking at it, they had a good bench, too, aside from pitching. Like, I see Phil Gagliano and Eddie Spezio and Eddie Bresut and Bobby Tolan and Alex Johnson and Dave Ricketts. That was a pretty good team on the bench.
I guess, really, about the only one-sided edge man-to-man in comparison between the two clubs would be in right field. Enos Lauder over Roger Maris.
Well, at that stage in Maris' career,
Because Roger was playing on guts.
And Maris made a big contribution.
Oh, yes. Whenever a run had to be driven in, he did. He didn't hit much for average, but he knew how to play the game.
He was the most valuable player twice in the American League, and it wasn't all with his bat. He knew how to play, and made the good plays. And, of course, Slaughter did, too, and that's why we talk about the Hall of Fame. Slaughter's quest and our desire to see him in there. One of the key plays of that series, as Bob Burns recalls, was in the second game. The Yankees, traditionally, were the 5 o'clock shadow team, as they used to put it. They'd beat you late, and they won the opener, although the Cardinals rallied, but they lost. Second game, the Cardinals got a 3-1 lead. Keller hit a home run that tied the score in the eighth. Said, uh-oh, here it goes again. But the last of the eighth, Slaughter and Musial combined to put the Cardinals ahead. In the ninth inning, the Yankees opened with a base hit by Dickey, and Tuck Steinbeck, a real fast guy, ran for him. Buddy Hassett, who played first base after Johnny Sturm went into service, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Buddy Hassett hit a ball down the right field line. Slaughter raced over, cut the ball off. Now, that's his left hand, the glove hand, had a wheel, and made one of the greatest throws I believe I've ever seen, and he threw out Steinbeck by a whisker at third base. Otherwise, it'd have been runners on first and third, nobody out. And then Red Ruffing pinch hitting, hit a fly ball that would have at least tied it. But instead, Beasley won that game 4-3. The great Yankees had been beaten late for a change, and boy, that changed the whole series.
And in the final game, after Kurowski hits the home run to put the Cardinals ahead in the final game, 4-2 in the ninth inning, Joe Gordon led off the bottom of the ninth with a double. And he's picked off second base by Walker Cooper.
But that was on a messed up bunt play, I think, Bob. I think Pretty missed a bunt play, and therefore I think he started a move. But, of course, even great players, are prone to make boo-boos, too.
But Gordon was the most valuable player in the American League that year and had a bad series, had only two hits.
And Cooper had a great year. He was the MVP in 44, and he had a poor series, too.
Beaten once and knocked out a second time.
So that 67 series, I remember... Brague in Boston hopping off a bus to get a sandwich for it. He was concerned about Bob Gibson's digestive tract.
What it was that day, we were staying out, as they pronounced it in Boston, Quincy rather than Quincy. Quincy, Massachusetts, at this motel, and breakfast was a mess. He couldn't get any service, as if they were deliberately not feeding him. Mm-hmm. And so they finally offered him a piece of burnt toast. He disdainfully walked away. We got on the bus, as Jack said. And, of course, at that time, I had an ulcer where I was so concerned about my stomach And when he said he hadn't anything to eat, I could see, oh, my God, here we go down the drain. Well, having worked in Boston, I knew the town, so I had the bus driver drop me off, and I got a couple ham and egg sandwiches for him, and he ate one then, and the second one he ate, he drank with a champagne in celebration.
I think before you got there, though, Bobby, I had a couple of donuts as well.
Oh, did he? Yeah. You ruined my story.
I think one thing we ought to do is compare them position by position. And then let Tim O'Neill explain to us how, since I can see neither team losing this game, how some team is going to lose it. First base, of course, Johnny Hop.
No contest.
Against Orlando Cepeda. Cepeda having his greatest season.
Right.
That's one for the 67. The second base, Jimmy Brown and occasionally Frank Crespi against Julian Javier. Javier had another fine season. Brown had a season of being the leader, of being the fiery guy that got things. But position play for play, Javier was better. And shortstop, Marion over Maxville, I think, even though I like Maxville. But Marion was great in 42.
Oh, yeah. Well, he was without a doubt. Great fielder his whole career and a better hitter.
Now you had two third basemen, Kurowski and Shannon. Both of them hit the long ball. Both of whom...
I think Mike probably better defensively.
Yeah. But Kurowski had a big bat. Left field is one of the great studies, Musial and Brock. Of course, you'd have to give it to Musial, but
strangely enough, Bob, Musial himself said he would call that about even.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess because Brock's fine, you know, Brock had 21 home runs that season. So I guess that because of Musial's all-around ability, I suppose maybe,
well,
maybe you're inclined to give him an edge.
Well, you're going on the one season.
Yeah.
See, Stan was a rookie, hitting .315, which was third high in the league. Ernie Lombardi led with .330. Slaughter hit .318. Musial hit .315. It was a pitcher's year. So if you're playing this game on a computer, you're playing a Musial of .315, not a .330 career Musial. And what did Brock hit for average that year, Jack?
I think, where can we find him? I think about .299.
Well, see,
21 homers.
Yeah, right.
And a lot of stolen bases.
And I tell you, they played that game at the old Sportsman's Park with that 310 porch. I mean, I think Brock might have hit about 30 homers or so.
I see in center field now, Flood had his best year in hitting, .335, correct?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Right.
Whereas Bob and I know that overall Moore had more power and was a maybe even greater center fielder, so that... Again, you're dealing with single seasons, and Moore had an inspirational fact that was probably the greatest on the ball club because he was the senior man, and he drove those guys. He had finished second in 35, 36, 39, and 41, a team that Burns traveled with, which probably set the character for the 42 club, was with more injuries than any ball club probably has ever had.
Yeah.
That ball club could have, should have, and would have, as Branch Rickey would put it, won the pennant if it hadn't been for all those injuries.
I think Bob touched on the bench strength of these two clubs. The name that intrigues me is John Romano. I had forgotten he was on that club because I remember
He didn't play.
I remember trying to interview him when someone... And he said, well, I'll talk to you when I do something. I think that was the last time I ever talked to him.
He'd had a good season with the White Sox and came out. I was very happy when the Cardinals made the deal. I can't remember who they gave up for, but I thought he would help, and he didn't.
Well, I remember one play in Pittsburgh where there was a man on second base, and he went over to cover first base, and the man on second walked home. That's the one thing I remember about John Romano.
Other thing I remember about John Romano has nothing to do with this, but he was at the All-Star game in Boston a couple of years later, with his father from New Jersey, and a couple of brothers, and they're talking, and the father says, "Joe DiMaggio here today," and Romano says, "No, Papa, Joe DiMaggio has retired." And the old man says, "I want to go home. I came here to see DiMaggio."
And the player compares. I think we forgot to compare McCarver and Walker Cooper.
Well, again, what was it? Well, you get the figures there on the year.
We also haven't gone into Maris and Slaughter, but.
Well, I think you'd give the edge to Enos, I think, for that 1 year.
Right. Well, Slaughter's second highest hitting in the league. And one run regression here that I think is a sad thing is that using Slaughter and Moore as two classic examples on the Cardinals, and there were other classic examples, DiMaggio was another.
Yeah.
These men who then missed the three best years in their career now must be equated over their careers with ballplayers who played out their entire careers when they come up for Hall of Fame eligibility, and that is a strong point. These men did. Slaughter was at his peak. Moore was at his peak. When they came back, Slaughter, of course, still was young enough to have many good years, but Moore, through bad fields, et cetera, and had gone over the edge. I think that's a shame, but that's something we always ought to remember in evaluating these guys, that they didn't have their full careers.
Now, what about the catchers, fellas? Walker Cooper and Tim McCarver, you could argue that one all night and all day.
On that one season, I'd have to rate Tim McCarver the edge. Defensively, of course, to Walker Cooper.
Yeah, yeah.
But offensively, I think Tim would rate it. Having hit .295 with 14 homers and 69 RBIs.
He finished second MVP,
that's
too, right?
Yeah. And whereas Walker Cooper had only 7 homers and 65. And but defensively, I think, as you recall, I think Cooper would rate
gun,
an edge.
Gun for an arm and an excellent handler of pitchers.
Yeah, because he went on to, he was like two different men physically. Yeah. The lean, rawhide, kind of mean, but lean and rangy. And then the big, bulky man who hit 35 home runs a year when he was over the Giants, yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, Tim, suppose you tell us now how we're going to decide this. The two
I think it's going to be a tie.
We beat, yeah.
Is this a tie, Tim?
Well, I guess on this, the Cardinals will win the game. It really... We played a lot of series between these two teams, and it really was pretty much a toss-up between this. And I think with Gibson, according to the computer, Gibson really did give 67 the edge. Yeah. And as you all pointed out, I think position by position, you might have to give the nod the 67 on paper. But there was something about the speed and, lack of a better word, continuity of the 42 club that really made him a real contender. And I don't want to give out the result here, but I hope it doesn't rain on Monday night for the ball game.
Cheney says there'll be a 3-3 tie, and the game will be continued the following year.
The only thing I say, I cannot see an outfield of Terry Moore, Enos Slaughter, and Stan Musial not doing well against the 67 team. I don't care if they got DiMaggio, Williams, and Clemente playing.
Yeah, well, my sum up is that if they were playing a series, a 4 out of 7, World Series, I'd give the edge of the 42 club, but with one game, with a great bow respect to Bob Gibson, who was as great a competitor as I ever saw, I'd have to give him a one game edge.
Okay,
I don't see how you can vote any other way. That's the way I'd see this. On the basis of one contest, I think Gibson, I think, you know, based on his track record, would deserve to give the 67 club it.
All right, now again, Tim, and I'm flying blind on this. Is it possible or logical or likely that either pitcher will go the distance?
I think there's according to their records and how many complete games they did, I think there's a real strong possibility of that.
As Gibson would say, he never wanted relief. Mm. You know, he pitches the way he had fun. He says, I'm going to go all the way in both areas.
Yeah, he did. I'm looking at the sheet now. I don't want anybody to think I memorized this. Cooper completed 22 out of 35.
He wanted to
go. So, yeah, he was a great nine-inning pitcher. That was, of course, the greatest year of Cooper's career, as he won 20 for the first of three successive years. But even though Gibson was hurt, and Red Sheehan did a great job of bringing him back just in time to start his, or really, yeah, start, because he really had kind of staggered at the finish of 64, but his great streak of World Series pitching was at its peak then, and he was certainly the blue-chip World Series guy when we know that he had the record of 7 straight consecutive complete game victories, which is a record.
One other thing about Mort Cooper, he did win plus 20, but in the middle of the season, just before the Cardinals started their great drive around the 10th of August, he was in a slump. I think he had 3 stabs at his 13th victory and had trouble. So from then on, through the 19th, he changed uniforms. He wore the uniform number 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, and reeled off 6 straight victories.
Even though some of his uniforms were a little tight, he did, didn't he? Yeah.
And then he was knocked out in Philadelphia in a game which he did not want to come out of. And that was number 19, I think it was. And the Cardinals won the game, but he said, that ends this thing. From now on, I'll use my own number.
And strangely, it was at Philadelphia that Gibson pitched the pennant clincher.
Right.
Because I remember they were about to tossed Gussie Bush into a shower, and then the lights, suddenly there was a power failure, and I think Gussie was rushed out of the clubhouse and was spared the little extracurricular shower.
I think somebody else was spared a lot of trouble, too.
The 42 team won it at home on the final day of the season, and I've always told Marty Marion this was a great moment. Let me recall a great moment of both 42 and 67. 1942, the Cardinals had come from way back. Now they're playing the Cubs, a doubleheader at the Sportsman's Park on the last day. And they won the opening game. And we're all in the clubhouse afterwards. And the guys come in, they're grim as they had been for a month and a half, not saying much. And about the sixth guy in was Marty Marion. And there's a lot of silence. And suddenly Marty said, "We just won the pennant. Somebody say something." Mm-hmm. And the whole place exploded. Then a great celebration, but it was the last day of the season, and then on the 1967 Cardinals, Roger Maris had one of the greatest lines in the history of baseball. After they won the World Series, they flew back to St. Louis. There was a post-midnight party at Stan and Biggie's restaurant, and Harry Carey put a microphone in front of a lot of people and asked the reaction, and the last one he talked to was Roger Maris. And Maris, who had been terribly unhappy at New York, and understandably so, because they gave him the back of their hand to him. But Maris said, "I had almost forgotten how much fun it is to play this game," which I thought was one of the most memorable lines I've ever heard.
It truly was. Yeah. One of the funny stories about the Cardinals showing the difference in times, the era of Sam Braden ownership. Any time he got a salary up to $15,000, I think he got very nervous. He wanted to unload you. And now, of course, $15,000 was a lot of money by comparison now, but still it was reasonably modest. But that was a kind of his goodbye amount. So Lon Warnke was the top paid player on that club at 15. He dealt him around the trading deadline to Chicago for cash, which was one of the favorite Cardinal commodities. And the press were pretty bitter about it, and so were the fans. But he said, "Well, this will give Beasley more opportunity." Of course, typical Braden luck, he was correct. But the funny thing about Warnke, Warnke had trouble with the Dodgers. A lot of clubs had trouble with the Dodgers because the Dodgers were knocking down the hitters right and left much more than was ordinary at a time when beanballs were a part of the game. So there was a great anger with the Brooklyn club managed by Leo Durocher. So late in the season, the Cardinals lost a game to the Cubs. You covered that game, our listen. I think 1-0.
Yeah.
Cooper beat Warnke in Chicago the second last Sunday.
Did
Hop steal home?
I believe so.
That was a thrilling game. So he was trying real hard, but on the last day of the season, when the Cardinals needed to win any one of the two games of the doubleheader, he pitched the opener, Warnke, against the Cardinals. This time, I think White was pitching for the Cardinals. Mm-hmm. The Cardinals did rough him up and got him out of the game. In the old days, the old ballpark, as fans will recall, the home dugout was third base, and players on both sides often went through it because the clubhouses were right behind it, and they didn't want to walk on that concrete around the stand. So he walked across the field through the dugout without looking left or right. Straight ahead, he said to the Cardinals as he went through, "All right, you so-and-sos, you got the lead. Now let's see you hold it." And because he wanted to see them win, and they did.
You mentioned the game in Chicago when the Cardinals, I think, really showed them they had a chance when they won that game that Cooper pitched over Warnke 1-0. The last batter for Chicago was Dim Dom D'Alessandro, who was built like a fire plug and just about as tall. And Cooper struck him out eventually to win the game. But D'Alessandro must have fouled off 20 pitches, and it was one of these things, it was power against power. Cooper just kept firing fastballs, and D'Alessandro kept fouling off, and finally he got one by him, and that's how they won the game.
That's fine, gentlemen. I want to thank you all for joining us for our pregame show, and
good.
We hope you all enjoy the game that's coming up.
Very good. Okay.
Hope it's not rained out.
Yeah, right. Thanks for saying, let's play two.